is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcasts here, I educate you, the public, on genetic and health topics through event coverage, news stories, book movie reviews, and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, and professors. Joining me today are Dr. David Bick, Carol Aiken, and Megan Cochran from Smith Family Clinic for Genomic Medicine in Huntsville, Alabama. Dr. David Bick is a board-certified clinical geneticist and clinical molecular geneticist with over 20 years of clinical experience. He sees patients and families who are struggling with a rare, undiagnosed, or misdiagnosed disease and are considering genetic testing specifically for whole genome sequencing. Carol Aiken is a certified medical practice administrator with the Professional Association of Healthcare Office Management. She has over 30 years of medical practice administration experience across multiple physician practice specialties and hospitals. Megan Cochran is a board-certified genetic counselor with clinical experiences in pediatric, adult medicine, and genomics. As one of the genetic counselors at Smith Family Clinic, she works with patients and families to understand the role of genomic medicine in healthcare and help them to incorporate this new information into their decision-making process. And so my first interview is with Dr. David Bick and Carol Aiken, and my second interview is with Megan Cochran.
The question that you asked was, what's unique about the Smith Family Clinic? What we consider really special about the clinic is that we can provide patients with a diagnostic testing process that includes not only all of the things that you can typically find in most genetics clinics, looking at various specific DNA tests or biochemical tests, but we've found that because these patients that we're seeing are on a diagnostic odyssey, they've seen many patients, often we're finding that they've done all of the logical testing that would be worth doing, and that a number of them need to have their whole genome sequenced as a way of identifying the cause of the disease for that individual. And so what's really special about the clinic is that we've integrated whole genome sequencing into the routine practice of genetics.
And so for a patient that maybe isn't as familiar with genetic testing, what is the difference between a whole genome and a whole exome sequence? What is the different levels that you're really looking at someone's genome and the information you're able to get from it?
Yes, so the question is, how does exome and genome differ? And maybe the other part of the puzzle is, how does that differ from other sorts of genetic testing? So when we see patients, let's say for a neurologic condition, there are some conditions whereby if you saw the patient, you would say, all right, I think that this patient fits most closely with such and such disease. So for example, we saw a patient who possibly had Huntington's disease last week or maybe the week before. And in that situation, because of the patient's history and because of the physical exam, we were fairly confident that this was going to turn out to be Huntington's disease. So we sent off that particular test. But another patient might come along who says, well, I'm having this problem with walking. My legs have become very stiff in the last 10 years, and I think I might have something called spastic paraplegia. Well, in that situation, it turns out that there's probably 50 or 100 or 200 genes that are connected to that condition, and we can, again, do something more narrow, just look at those particular genes. Where it becomes very complicated are patients where they've seen a lot of different geneticists, done specific tests or some of these gene panels, and then people have said, well, maybe we should do an exome. Well, an exome is only looking at 1% of your genome. It only looks at the coding parts of the gene, whereas a whole genome looks at the entire genome. So instead of just looking at the 1% that's the coding region, with a whole genome, we can look at everything. Now, clearly, we know the most about the so-called coding regions, but when you put a whole genome side by side with an exome, even the parts that the exome tests are supposed to be good at, a genome is better, and it also allows you to look at the parts of the genome that the exome can't see.
So it's much more of a comprehensive test, and this can be really helpful for patients that are maybe undiagnosed or have a rare disease And if they're undiagnosed, that can be a long journey. It takes an average of 7 years to actually get a correct diagnosis.
Correct. And another piece of the puzzle is that we know that whole genome sequencing and whole exome sequencing, in fact, any technology, may fail to identify a cause for the patient's condition. Well, one of the reasons for that is because among the 20,000 genes in humans, perhaps 5,000 have been connected to a genetic disease, but the other 15,000, we might know what that gene does. It might be a heart gene or a brain gene or a kidney gene, but mistakes in that gene have never been connected to a human condition. So there's still lots to be discovered. And here's where the beauty of whole genome sequencing comes in. If you sequence someone's whole genome, even if you don't find the answer, you can simply look back at it every year and a half or 2 years and see, has a new gene been discovered? Whereas with exome, you might be able to look back at that to see if something new has been discovered, but you'd always wonder, well, maybe the answer wasn't in the exome. Maybe it was in the other 99% of the genome. So even if you do an exome and you don't get the answer, now you have to turn around and do a genome. Whereas with a genome, once you've got it, it's in the laboratory, you can always look back at the data as frequently as you like.
And so what makes a patient actually eligible or, you know, qualifies to get this whole genome sequencing? Obviously, it's very expensive compared to exome, as you're looking at much more information.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to just add to that and let Dr. Bick answer the clinical aspect of that. Being unique as a true medical office here, we are not part of an institutional or hospital setting. So this is just a regular medical office, and obviously HIPAA compliant. The patients that present to Dr. Bick, he is very fiscally conservative, extremely focused on the medical necessity based off of each individual patient. So he will focus his attention on what is the fiscally conservative answer for testing. And he's not automatically going to just jump to a whole genome on everybody. The other thing that makes us a little bit more unique is the fact that being a medical office, we do have the very nice ability to work with outside genetic labs that can make this testing for the patients, if it's a single gene or a lab panel, very cost effective. They do file insurance. They can make it very cost effective. If we get to the whole genome standpoint, where typically insurance does not cover a whole genome at this present time, then I can have the ability to work with the patient once we know it's medically necessary to get them set up to get that whole genome done. And I just work with them individually. But Dr. Bick can definitely share how he moves through those steps with the patients.
And Carol brings up a very important point. We're always wanting, and it's something that I had mentioned a little earlier, is that we're really focused on integrating whole genome sequencing into the routine practice of medicine. And in the routine practice of genetic medicine, we start with what seems to be the most straightforward approach to helping the patient. But we do know that there are a number of individuals where doing all of those sort of standard testing hasn't yielded an answer. And we've found that whole genome sequencing is an important part of that pipeline for finding those answers. Yes, it is an expensive test, and some families obviously pay out of pocket themselves. Right now, insurance companies have not been good about covering the cost of it. But one of the things that we have available to us is we do have patients who really can't afford to do whole genome sequencing, but we have the ability through what's called the HERO Fund that if there's a financial need, that fund will supplement some of those costs. Carol, you want to mm-hmm. say something?
It will supplement those. Dr. Bick and Megan will let me know if they're going to recommend a whole genome for a patient so that I already have it sort of in my head that a particular patient is going to need it. And then I can begin to lay the groundwork with them from their personal financials to gather the appropriate medically necessary paperwork from them financially to get them qualified for the HERO Fund. It's not a very difficult process. It's relatively easy. And sometimes they qualify for full coverage of the whole genome, and sometimes it could be partial at 80% or 50%. Or as Dr. Bick said, there are some patients that simply pay out of pocket.
And you hinted at it earlier that you're hoping for this to become really standard of care. And that's what your practice is really aiming for, that you're saying that if a patient really qualifies and would benefit from whole genome sequencing, that you're going to make it happen. How do you see this kind of changing in a larger scale of, you know, outside of the perspective of your clinic? Do you see this becoming a standard of care, you know, for, you know, people that are undiagnosed within our healthcare system?
Yes, I do see that whole genome sequencing really is going to be the way to go. And the truth is that in certain states, with certain insurance companies, if you provide them with a letter of medical necessity, they will cover the cost of whole genome and whole exome sequencing. But right now, that's sort of a state by state and insurance company by insurance company process. What I see happening is, first of all, the cost of the testing is going to go down as the equipment and so forth becomes more efficient. But also, there have been quite a number of papers that have come out to show that whole genome sequencing is going to be moved further and further to the front of the diagnostic testing process. So in other words, if you would see a patient who had, say, severe learning disabilities, typically we might do some metabolic testing, we might look for Fragile X syndrome, we might do a chromosome analysis, we might do another test called a microarray. Well, with a whole genome, in the very near future, not only will you be able to do what the microarray does, but you'll be able to do what the genome, looking at all of the other DNA changes from the genome. Because when you see patients with, for example, learning problems, some of them have a whole gene missing, and some of them just have a single letter changed in a particular gene. And this technology is allowing us to do both of those things and start to eliminate some of the earlier tests so that this becomes more and more cost efficient for the whole healthcare system.
And it really makes sense to look at a larger picture for people that have different diseases that are a little bit more maybe generalized and not very specific syndromes or symptoms, so that, you know, it makes sense to look at the whole genome because you're not really sure where to start, whereas the other testing that you mentioned is a little bit more specific, that if you think a patient has Huntington's disease, for example, you said before, that you can test for that specific gene and see how many repeats they have. But as you said, for someone that has a learning disability, there's not really, you know, oh, let's check for this specific genes. We know much less about that.
Right. And we know that the number of genes connected to, you know, severe learning problems is quite a long list. And so by the time you start looking at those one at a time, or even a panel of them, what happens is that you can look and know like what we kind of knew today, but a year from now or a year and a half from now, there's going to be a lot more genes discovered for these severe learning disability children. And we know that if you had the genome done to begin with, if it finds the answer, great. But if it doesn't, 18 months from now, when that new paper comes out, you can just open up the genome and take a look. I remember there was a patient back when I was in Wisconsin who had a rare condition called infantile myofibromatosis. And when we first looked at this patient's genome, we didn't have an answer. But then I remember this was in July, and a paper came out in June or July of that year. I read the paper, and all I did was I simply pressed the button on my computer and said, look for this gene mistake in my patient. And sure enough, it came right up, so that I was able to solve this patient's medical problem, figure out what they had, literally with a press of one button once I had read the paper.
It's just remarkable how much our technology is advancing, but also the knowledge that we have in the databases that we do to be able to merge those together to be making these changes. And as you said, we're discovering so much that it's so important for patients to be recontacting genetic counselors. I must say it on most of my genetic counseling kind of episodes, where, you know, it's so important for patients to do that, because you know, every other day there's brand new, you know, different gene variant discovered. And so, you know, we're all trying to keep up with the genetics.
Absolutely. It really is. And that's one of the beauties of the software package that we use to analyze genomes here. It's a software package called Codicum, C-O-D-I-C-E-M, Codicum. And what's beautiful about it is that when we look at a patient's genome today, it has incorporated the most up-to-date information from OMIM and other sources, and that a year from now, because that software package is constantly being updated, I know that when I go back into that patient's genome that I had from a year ago, it's going to filter it sort of with new information and available for all of the DNA changes that we see.
Well, thank you so much for, you know, enlightening us on how the whole genome sequencing is really going to be changing the field, especially for people that are undiagnosed and hopefully diagnosing people sooner than that average of 7 years. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
So thank you so much, Megan, for coming on the show and joining me and learning about Smith Family Clinic for Genomic Medicine. I'd love to hear about what your role is and how you contribute.
Sure. So I am one of three certified genetic counselors that work with the Smith Family Clinic for Genomic Medicine. And really our role is throughout the process of a patient being referred to us, being seen, and then on the post-visit side. So we do help triage cases that come in to see who may be appropriate for testing to try to identify patients that we could be most helpful to. During the appointment, I work closely with Dr. Bick to help gather history, specifically family history, but a lot of other bits of information about the patient's personal medical and family history. And then once we have that, all of those things together, Dr. Bick and I work together to make a plan for what we want to offer the patient. And then the largest role that's specific to a genetic counselor is to really explain, here's where we think we're going. Here are the options that are available to you. Here are some benefits and limitations, and really helping facilitate the decision-making process for that patient.
And this can be a really hard role to have because you're explaining really complex information to people of a wide variety of educational backgrounds. So when you're meeting with these patients and families, what kind of strategies do you take to make sure that this information is, you know, getting across to them so they can make these informed healthcare decisions?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, I think step one in most cases is just to kind of figure out where the patient is at. You know, we have a wide diversity of patients. Some of the folks we've seen have had PhDs and MD degrees, so they're potentially starting from a place of a little bit higher genetic and genomic literacy, whereas a lot of our patients, especially those who are either very young or in our senior citizens, are not familiar with genetics at all. And so the first thing we try to do is get a read on how familiar they are to begin with, and then kind of tailor the explanations to them from there. We definitely use a lot of analogies to try to break things down to a simpler level and make people be able to relate these really complex things to things they'd be maybe more familiar with. So, for instance, comparing genes to a recipe and how you can have different types of mistakes either in the way the recipe is printed or the way it's executed. Things like that that can provide that kind of real life association, I think, helps make things a lot easier for folks to understand.
Definitely, when you can put it in terms of something else that they're very familiar with, like cooking, that everybody has, you know, done that in their lives, you know, patients can kind of understand where the information is and everything. And so in this role, do you work, you mentioned that you're one of three genetic counselors at Smith Family Clinic. So do you work directly with the other genetic counselors, or do you kind of approach different cases?
So I'm actually the primary clinical counselor for the Smith Family Clinic at this time. So all three of our genetic counselors wear multiple hats. And the hat that we all share is of clinical application specialists and genetic counselors at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology, which is one of the institutions that kind of power the Smith Family Clinic. And so we all work very closely together at Hudson Alpha on a variety of overlapping projects. I'm the one whose primary role is at the clinic, but the other counselors definitely are there on a less frequent basis, as either I'm out or sometimes when we have a high volume, they come in and help cover those cases as well.
And it kind of goes to show just how many different ways that genetic counselors can be involved in the healthcare setting, and just, you know, they're not all necessarily in clinical roles. You know, they can be in research and in a variety of other, you know, areas. Now, for patients that you're meeting with, many of these rare diseases don't have cures or treatments. So when a patient's diagnosed and it fits in that category, how does it change their life? What are you looking at in terms of kind of next steps for them?
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, a very small number of our patients, we will find a diagnosis that will directly tell them, here's what you do to fix it. Here's what we can do to drastically change your medical situation. But in a lot of cases, that's not the case. And so, you know, the things that we can tell them, in some cases we can say, you can stop looking. A lot of patients have been on this diagnostic odyssey and have had so many procedures. A lot of them can be very invasive. And so for some people, just being able to stop that is extremely helpful. In some cases, we can tell them other body systems that need to be looked after that they may not have known in advance. So just in the world of medicine, there are those things. But for a lot of people, and kind of where I like to look at things from the counseling side, is from a psychosocial perspective of, now we have an answer. We can stop asking why and move on with our lives. And for a lot of patients, that's a huge thing. They've wondered for so long. You know, a lot of our parents have carried around guilt of, did I do something wrong, or did I not do something that I should have? And when we can say, no, this is because of a random genetic change that you had no control over, that can really help them to put aside that guilt and move on. In a lot of other cases, it can provide information on the chances that this could happen again in the family, which especially for our folks who have affected young children is a major question. And then also it allows them to connect with other families and researchers. You know, sometimes we make a diagnosis of something that's so rare that that family's pediatrician or other specialists have never heard of it and might never hear of it. But now in the age of internet connectivity and social media, they can go on and find other families with the same diagnosis and make that connection. And I think that's incredibly valuable for our patients.
It's so powerful for patients to meet people that are, you know, in very similar situations of them, of having the same disease or a related disorder. And just of the few that I've seen, that they're able to pull together and, you know, start different research foundations and things that, you know, when your child has a rare disease, you're the one that's most empowered to find a cure. And so it's really inspirational to see these families come together and, you know, be looking for treatments and in additional research.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we've seen several cases lately, both here and in the news, of families who have come together not just for support, but also to raise funds and start foundations. And some of them have made major impacts on research into their particular disease. And so that's wonderful to see.
And it's kind of the patient taking a much more active role in healthcare. And it's an exciting kind of way that people can get much more involved with the All of Us Project and different things that are happening, that things are definitely changing very quickly.
Absolutely.
And so, Smith Family Clinic has put together a few cases on your website. Can you share one of them with us so we get a better glimpse of what, not necessarily a typical patient looks like, but what a patient might be like that's coming into the clinic?
Sure. So one of our symptoms, and I think this is a good one to share, because a lot of people have this idea that genetics is the realm of childhood, but that's not necessarily the case. So one of our patients was actually a 60-year-old individual who had a very long history of muscle weakness, elevated muscle enzymes, and loss of muscle mass. And he was somebody who had really kind of taken his health into his own hands and said, you know, I have trouble building muscle. I have this weakness. I'm going to make myself strong. And so he had spent a lot of time trying to build muscle mass through exercise and working out, but it never worked for him. And so when we saw him, we said, you know, you've had this condition for 30, 40 years now. We think we have some testing to offer to solve it. And so in this case, we actually did not use a whole genome sequence. We used a smaller panel from a commercial laboratory, because one of the things we try to do is do the test that makes the most sense first. And in this case, it made sense to look at a smaller group of genes. We actually did find the answer for him, a type of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. And based on the specific gene change we found for him, not only were we able to say, we think this is where this came from. We think this is your prognosis, which was actually, I think, better than he had anticipated. We were able to tell him this was going to be, you know, very slowly progressive, probably not going to be life limiting or anything like that. And we were also actually able to tell him that all of that working out he was doing was actually making his condition worse. And so we were able to give him some, although we couldn't have a cure for him, we were able to give him some advice on things that he could do to better improve his strength and flexibility and muscle mass, where he actually wasn't damaging the muscles like he had been doing.
And so for him, this result really changed things because he altered certain things in his lifestyle so that it was actually more beneficial towards his health, as opposed to maybe more kind of traditional treatment that, you know, folks may think of, oh, take this medication or, you know, get this kind of screening done or something. But for him, it was changing his exercise levels.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so you mentioned whole genome sequencing. A question I had about that was how common it is to have additional relevant information through whole genome sequencing and how you handle things called secondary or incidental findings, which maybe you could define for us.
Sure, absolutely. So when we think about a whole genome sequence, primary findings are findings that are identified that have to do with why a person is seeking the test. So for instance, a patient who is being tested because they have muscle weakness or myopathy, primary findings would be things that deal with your muscles. Secondary findings are, I think in some ways people view them as kind of Pandora's box of everything else you could find if you go looking in a genome. Because when you cast the net that wide, you're not only looking at genes associated with the patient's symptoms, you're looking at everything. And so we call those secondary findings. And the way we do it is we kind of divide things into categories or buckets. We say one category is pharmacogenetics, so genetic changes that affect the way a person's body processes medications. And I would say most people will have at least a couple of those. We'll say, you know, for a certain medication, maybe you need a higher or lower dose or to consider an alternative medication. The next category is carrier status. So for recessive conditions, a person who has one copy of the gene that has an alteration, but the other one is normal, that person is a carrier. They're not expected to have symptoms, but could pass the disease on to their children. I would say, again, most folks who get whole genome sequencing will have at least one carrier status identified. And that's because we're all carriers for something, no matter of whether or not we find it. And then the last group of secondary findings are things that indicate that a person is at very high risk to develop a condition in the future. And we think about those in two categories, one being treatable, which would be a, for instance, a hereditary cancer predisposition syndrome, something like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. And we consider those treatable because if we know that somebody has a pathogenic change in one of those genes that puts them at high risk, there are things we're going to tell them to do differently. They're going to start surveillance earlier. There may be medication interventions. There may be surgical interventions to change that outcome for them. And then there's untreatable things like a hereditary form of Alzheimer's disease, where at this point, medicine doesn't have an answer for that. There's nothing that we know medically that somebody can do to change their outcome. But it's not to say that it's not worth knowing. Some people would use that information to make decisions about financial planning or taking that trip or family planning. And we think that patients and their families are in the best place to make a decision about what information they would and would not want back. And so we don't take it as a one-size-fits-all approach. We spend a lot of time talking with the patient through, here are all the potential outcomes of things we might find. If we saw those, would you want to know? Do you even want the lab to look for those things? A lot of our patients say, that's why I'm here. I want everything. Whereas we have a lot of patients who say, you know, I'm here for one specific question. That other stuff, I can't even deal with that right now. I don't want that. And anywhere in between. And so it really demonstrates that the patients and their families themselves are the best ones to make that decision.
It's definitely really important for a genetic counselor or another healthcare provider that is trained in genetic testing to sit down with patients and really go through this because it's a lot of information. And, you know, as you said, some patients may not want to know. And that's an important thing to establish before the testing is done and before the results are coming back and everything. So thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all this insight with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anybody has any questions, I really encourage them to get in touch with us here at the clinic. I think, Kara, you have our contact information, and we're happy to take questions from patients or providers who may have patients that they think of who could be appropriate.
Their website is smithfamilyclinic.org. Twitter, Smith Genomic Med, M-E-D. Instagram, Smith Family Clinic. And their Facebook, Smith Family Clinic for Genomic Medicine. And all those links will be on my website, dnapodcast.com. I'm on Twitter at DNA Podcast, Instagram at DNA Radio. And any questions about any of today's content can be sent into info@dnapodcast.com. Appreciate you guys listening to today's episode. You can join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.